So great to have you back, Lori. And
Becoming a routine, isn't it? You're all.
let's talk about, are you going to say something?
No, I just saw one of the commenters in your saying, why is this Johnson guy suddenly showing so much hatred for Israel? I don't hate Israel. I hate what the Israelis are doing. They're killing women and children. They're a bunch of murdering thugs. And people that want to deny that and pretend that everything that Israel is doing is okay, and that if you point it out, I mean, let me just start with some facts. I've been hitting the facts. And so hopefully Ruben Lognathan is tuning in and understands this. We hear from the West frequently that Iran is the number one sponsor of terrorism in the world. Okay, back it up, prove it. How would you prove that? Well, one way to prove it is you'd look at the groups every year that commit the terrorist acts. And I can just pull up some those statistics for you here. And then you count up, you take the groups that are committing the most terrorist attacks, and you say, okay, who's sponsoring them? You know, who is providing the support? Well, if it was Iran, then of course Iran would be the number one terrorist group in the world. But that's not the case. When you look at the numbers are just the opposite. It shows that not of the top 10 terrorist groups, and some include ISIS, some include groups in Africa. Not a one, not a single one is under the control of Iran, is under the funded by Iran, trained by Iran. None. What we do know, we have the statistics from the Israeli Foreign Ministry. According to the Israeli Foreign Ministry, not Larry Johnson, not some Israeli hate group, from the Israeli government itself, from August of 2000 to April of 2024, April 24th, I believe, is the last date I pulled that data. In that period, they list every single terrorist attack against Israel by Palestinians. Every single one that resulted in death or injury of some sort. They exclude what happened on October 7th. They put the whole October 7th incident in terms of number of Israelis killed in a different category. So for April, for August 2000, for the next 24 years, a grand total of 1,425 Israelis were killed in terrorist attacks. Well, not trying to minimize the loss of life, but you know, Americans kill over almost 60,000 people a year in car accidents. So 1,425 over that period is nothing. But especially when you look at the fact that in that same period, the Israelis killed close to 8,000 Palestinian men, women, and children, not terrorists, civilians. So then let's take October 7th. Let's take at face value the Israeli claim that all 1,200 plus that were killed were done at the hands of Hamas. We know that's not true because we have actual evidence that the Israelis themselves killed a large number of their Israeli compatriots. But let's just give Israel that 1,200. Well, since October 7th, the Israelis have killed more than 45,000 civilians. They've killed journalists, they've killed healthcare workers, they've killed aid workers, they've killed clergy, both Muslim and Christian. They've killed emergency responders, first responders. If you can even go by the old biblical standard of an eye for an eye, This is disproportionate. They're killing tens of thousands of civilians. And they want to call Iran the murdering state? Facts just don't back them up. You know, you can say that. And when you try to argue it with any of these Zionist zealots, you know, they'll deny it, and it's fine. Let them deny it. But it's, you know, the facts are the facts.
Yeah. Larry, just look at this picture that shows the level of casualties on the part of in these cross-border attacks between Hezbollah and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the number of attacks you see from Israelis, from Hezbollah, from Israelis, 8,313. And Hezbollah is 8,901. And you see at the level of casualties, Larry, you see the casualties 752 and 33 on the part of Hezbollah. Hezbollah killed 33 Israelis, and they have killed more than 750 Lebanese. And when you look at these statistics, it's just between October 7 to September 20th.
Yeah, I mean, look, the numbers are what the numbers are. So if you're going to be an honest person, if you're going to objectively evaluate data, go with the data. The numbers are right there. Israel is a bunch of murdering thugs. They're killing women, children, civilians. Their targets are not military targets. The majority of targets are civilian targets. And they always use the excuse, oh, we're fighting terrorism. Except the biggest terrorist threat in the Middle East, in my view, based upon the numbers, if you're defining terrorism as acts of violence against unarmed civilians, it's Israel. Not Hamas, not Hezbollah, and certainly not Iran.
Yeah. The other concept would be the way that they're attacking the attacks. We've seen that even Houthis are capable to hit the heart of Israel. But they didn't hit the civilian part of Israel.
Yeah, and when you look at a lot of the Hezbollah attacks in particular, they focused on military targets. Because if they didn't, you would have a large total of civilian casualties. If Hezbollah was shooting indiscriminately at Israelis, there would be a large number of Israeli casualties. And then when I'm presenting the statistics, I'd say, Hamas launched, almost 800 attacks over that 24-year period, and they killed 30,000 Israelis. Okay, tell you what, not what happened. So just stop listening to the press. Stop listening to all the politicians offering just pure bullshit for opinion. Look at the facts. Go to the source. My sources on this are the U.S. government, State Department's Bureau of Counterterrorism. Every year they prepare a country report on terrorism. And those statistics are collected by the National Counterterrorism Center, which used to be part of the CIA. Okay. And the other source of the data is the Israeli Foreign Ministry. So if you don't like the facts, go talk to the Israelis, go talk to the US government. That's what they're collecting.
Yeah. As we talk, Larry, it seems that Israelis are crossing the border and just entering into Lebanon. And do we know they're talking about a limited operation? What would that mean?
That's like talking about a limited pregnancy. No such thing as a limited pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not. Okay. So enough with this limited operation. What was the attack of Gaza over the last 12 months? A limited operation? When you're killing tens of thousands of civilians, and you're destroying homes, and you're destroying infrastructure, you're destroying water, you're destroying electric power plants, you're destroying schools, you're destroying hospitals. I don't know if that constitutes limited. So, Israel is You know, they're following what I call the Ukrainian model. They're announcing in advance. Okay, here we come. All right, we're coming. Yep, here we come. Now they're doing it. Hezbollah, I think, is ready and waiting for them, and we'll see in the coming week or so that if Israel tries to push out, how deep Israel tries to push into Lebanon. We've got to step back and say, how has Israel done over the last 12 months in Gaza? This is a limited area. It's defined on the western boundary by the ocean. So the Palestinians, unless they're really good swimmers, they can't escape that way. And even if they are good swimmers, the Israelis have naval patrol boats out there. The north and eastern boundaries are controlled by Israel. So the Palestinian walls, so they actually physical structures they have to breach. And then the southern part is Egypt and Israel. So with that kind of control over a small geographic area compared to the rest of Israel, the Israeli army has not been able to control it. Yeah, they've killed a lot of people. Yeah, they've forced people to move here, move there. They've blown up buildings. They've torn down infrastructure. And Hamas has recruited more people. And the attacks on Israelis continue. So now we're asked to believe that the Israeli army is now going to enter a territory where it has less control, where Hezbollah has greater defenses, where Hezbollah has more trained soldiers, where Hezbollah has more weaponry, more advanced weaponry, and more experience in combat, and that Israel's going to do better there? Okay, we'll see. Good luck with that. I think this is another example of Israeli arrogance and hubris, where their mouths are writing checks that their bodies can't cash. So all the tough talk and et cetera, it's going to come down. Can they get a tank up a mountain valley road? And what they're going up against in this part of Lebanon is not flat open plains. That is ideal tank country. It's more like Afghanistan. It's mountainous and rugged terrain, and it's ambush territory. And to top it off, Hezbollah has had years to build tunnels and facilities in those mountains.
Larry, when you look at the assassination of Nasrallah, in your opinion, what was the... Because when, in this new president in Iran, in his inauguration, we had the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. And right now, when he's in New York, and we know that his team was talking about, he gave an interview talking about peace, and we're going to find a political solution. And his team was trying to negotiate with Washington. And at the same time, we see that this happening in Lebanon. What can we understand from this? Is that related to what's going on between Iran and Washington? It's something beyond that. They were thinking of this even before new government in Iran come into power, the new president. How do you see these things together?
Israel's strategic objective is to destroy Iran and destroy every country that has a relationship with Iran. So that means killing Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. That means taking control of Lebanon. That means taking control of Yemen, destroying the Houthis, and ultimately going to war with Iran. I could share with you, I've received some emails from a rabid Zionist that I'm acquainted with. I can't really call the person a friend because I just fundamentally reject this person's bloodlust. But he's like all confident. Oh, man, Israel's going to show them now. Just like, you know, you got some trolls in your commentary. You know, oh, don't hit Israel or we'll hit you. Okay, we'll see what tune they're going to be singing in another 6 months. Israel is putting itself at greater risk with each passing day as it embarks upon this plan of action. Because they do not have the military resources to defeat Hezbollah. Hezbollah, at a minimum, has the ability to tie the Israelis up in a stalemate, at a minimum. They may even be able to, you know, strategically defeat the Israelis. Depends on what sort of missile technology they decide to bring to the table. But Israel's also talking about wanting to fight Syria, forgetting that Syria now has a military ally by the name of Russia. And it's claiming it wants to destroy Iran, going to attack Iran. Well, Iran's going to have a say in this because they've got air defense provided courtesy of the Russians. They've got a military defense treaty in place or agreement with Russia. Iran has been conducting military exercises with Russia and China for at least the last 4 years, in both naval and as well as ground-based military. So if Israel chooses to attack Iran, it could very well find itself fighting Russia and China. They're not going to stand by and let these bullies, these Zionist thugs, go around and terrorize everybody and get away with it. The payback's going to come at some point, and Israel's going to regret the day because they will have now burned bridges with Egypt, with Jordan, with Turkey. We see Israel is so caught up in its own press clippings that, yeah, they've carried out some lethal, devastating attacks against Hezbollah's leadership. But what does it? They didn't guarantee the elimination of Hezbollah leadership. They've already been replaced. The cousin of Nasrallah has taken over the head of Hezbollah. He also carries the title Sayyid, which he wears the black turban, which gives him special status within Islam. And he reportedly, according to Alistair Crook, Alistair told me he's far more radical than Nasrallah. Oh, good. So he'll be less likely to order restraint. He'll order unrestrained actions. Similarly, in Iran, this Pezeshkian, the new president, boy, did he screw up. Now, he admitted yesterday that he had had promises from the West, promises from Europe that, oh, if you hold your fire, if you don't retaliate against Israel, we'll provide you with relief from economic sanctions and welcome you back into the community of nations, and we'll work out peace. And he believed them. The dummy believed them. And they pull the rug right out from under him. They go ahead and continue murdering everybody they can in the Hezbollah chain of command. So now Pezeshkian is trying to talk tough, but he's facing real pushback from the Har in Iran, who says, don't trust the West, don't trust the Americans. And, this is this message is going beyond just Iran, because it's also resonating in Russia, because Russia's now had the same experience. They've seen time after time after time what the West has promised, what the West has guaranteed. They've lied, and they've refused to follow through on their promises. So and then on to add this to make it even more dangerous for what's going to happen in the coming week, 2 weeks. The death of Nasrallah, who is in many respects sort of celebrated like Nelson Mandela was during his lifetime. He was a respected figure, and now he's being mourned not just by the Shia Muslims, but also being mourned by Sunni Muslims. And the Sunni and Shia have long, you know, that's one of the reasons that, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah never really were working close together, coordinated fashion. Now they're going to. They're starting to drop the wall that separates them. Then, in addition, the street, the public opinion in Turkey, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and all Muslim countries are expressing outrage at this. And candidly, you know, I think the King Abdullah of Jordan could very well find himself ousted in a military action internal because he's seen as too compromised by the Israelis. So the Israelis with these kinds of acts, yeah, they talk tough and yeah, they kill some people. They killed the predecessor of Nasrallah 32 years ago, promising at the time that that would end the Hezbollah threat. Well, did it? No, it didn't.
And what's so amazing, when Nasrallah came to power and he was the leader, he became the leader of Hezbollah, he had 23 years old, Larry.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see how he hugely contributed to this expansion of Hezbollah, and the way Hezbollah is today is it was his art of leadership that Hezbollah became the entity, that the organization that we know today.
Well, yeah, and what's ironic about that is that, so during the 1980s, it started in 1982, and was immediately aggressively involved with attacks that the United States, we defined as terrorism, blowing up our embassy in Beirut twice, blowing up the what we call the Marine barracks once. That was in 83. Now, the United States views that as, that's terrorism. Well, not really. If it's an attack on a military target, you know, if you're blowing up military targets, that's not terrorism, that's war. So Hezbollah was fighting a war early on against the Americans for their backing, because Hezbollah wanted the people of Palestine to be free to govern themselves. But, you know, the United States characterized it as terrorism. There was a hijacking. I know that TWA 100, Robert Steedham, a Navy diver, he was murdered. Again, he was not in an official military capacity, and murdering him, in my view, constitutes terrorism. Particularly, he's unarmed. So during the 1980s, yeah, Hezbollah developed a relationship as a terrorist organization that attacked Americans. Hezbollah is blamed, though others point the finger at bin Laden, for the bombing of the apartment complex in Saudi Arabia in 1995, that the explosives came out of Lebanon, perhaps. That was true. But during the 1990s, and again, this is the time that Nasrallah takes over, Hezbollah starts scaling back and stopping terrorist attacks against the United States, number one, and scales back terrorist attacks against civilian targets in Israel. And how do we know that? We've got the statistics for 24 years from the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Again, it's not my opinion. Those are the facts. So, you know, here's Nasrallah, who really tried to push towards more diplomatic, more of a political solution. Still prepared militarily to fight, but his first instinct was not to fight, not to do battle. Killing him now takes away a possible moderate.
Because whenever we talk about what's the reason, what's the objective behind this behavior of Israel, at the end of the day, Larry, when you look at the way that they're attacking Lebanon, Gazans, Houthis, and even Syria, it seems that they don't want any sort of peace, any sort of political settlement, because that's all about two-state solution. They don't want two-state solution. They're trying to make enormous conflicts in the region in order to not talk about the substantial topics that would be how we can put an end to Gaza, to these operations in Gaza.
Yeah, so this is not about what I'd call secular politics. This is sectarian politics. This is religious politics. This is the religion of Zionist zealots who believe, sincerely believe, and I don't pretend that it's just contrived, their belief is that follow God's commandments, which is commanding them to exterminate the Palestinians. They're Amalek. I think it's in Deuteronomy, where according to the Old Testament, God chastises the Jewish kings, rulers, for not following his commandments to kill these infidels, if you will. So here you have people living, you know, thousands of years after that scripture was written, taking it as something that they must do today. And so their intent is they're going to eliminate the Palestinians. They'll eliminate the Lebanese, Jordanians if they have to, Syrians, Houthis, they don't care. They're following God's commands. Once you have convinced yourself that you can do anything because it's okay with God, that you develop a theology that allows you to do anything because God blesses it, then actually, you know, you're in the full grip of evil, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Larry, we've seen that it seems that the foreign ministers of Arab countries were talking about, we are going to give a guarantee to Israel for the future of Israel if they accept two-state solution and just stop attacking Gazans tomorrow, right now. And do you find it right now, the Arab states, do you find it any sort of willingness on their part to put pressure on the United States?
Not now.
Do they have that sort of leverage?
No. If you asked me that a month ago, I could have said maybe. But now, in light of the murder of Hassan Nasrallah, it's clear. It has become, I think, clear that Israel has no interest whatsoever in negotiating a settlement. None. They're going to destroy the Palestinians and take control of the land one way or the other. If they have to kill them, they kill them. They'd prefer to exile them, just force them out, starve them out, have them die from disease. They don't care. Because from the Zionist perspective, these Palestinians are subhuman. They're not human beings. They're not worthy of life. They can be disposed of like trash, the human trash that they are, according to the Zionist perspective. And so that message has gotten home, because even over the last 30 years, Israel has played a double game. They have managed to blame the Palestinians for failing to come to the table, failing to accept peace agreements. It's always the Palestinian fault. Except what wasn't revealed to the public is that Mossad, operating through cutouts, was funneling money to groups like Hamas and Hezbollah for the express purpose of using them to undermine, disrupt, sabotage peace talks. So that where Hamas would be, you know, at really what turned out to be at Israeli behest, not realizing they were, would sabotage, you know, not agree with the PLO or Fatah, particular agreement. And all those Palestinians, they're not interested in a serious agreement. And that was just Israel buying time.
In Gaza, we know that Netanyahu was talking with Gazans while they were attacking Gazans, that your enemy is Hamas. And before this attack on Nasrallah, he sent a video message. I don't know if he played on the other talk that we did, but in which he was doing the same thing, just removing Hamas and putting in Hezbollah, that Hezbollah is your enemy, talking to Lebanese mm-hmm. people. Today, he did the same thing to Iranians, and he called Iranian Persians, we have the old history, we are connected to each other, and your enemy is the government in Iran. And Larry, if we follow the path, that the way that he's behaving right now, can we expect that Israel is going to attack, going to assassinate people in Iran, leaders?
Yes. Yes. Well, they've already assassinated one. Haniyeh, he was not a leader of Iran, but there's some wondering, did the Israelis have a role in the death of President Raisi? So, yeah, no, short answer to your question, yes, Israel's going to try. And what they're going to do at one of these points, they will step so far over the boundaries of decency that it's going to elicit a significant retaliation that Israel is not prepared for and didn't expect. So, you know, you try to warn them away that there is another way if they're sincere about peace. But again, we're dealing with a level of fanaticism, and let me be clear: there's some on the Hamas and Hezbollah side who are equally fanatical. I'm not trying to pretend that they're all just, you know, Thomas Jefferson sitting around thinking great thoughts and writing, you know, extensive pieces of great literature on it. But the Israelis clearly, in this case, are playing a very dangerous game. And they seem intent on destroying, getting involved with as many wars as possible. That's what's crazy about it. We've got 12 months already, a year, of their military operations in Gaza. It's a confined area. And they couldn't handle that. And yet they're going to handle attacking Lebanon, attacking Iran, attacking Yemen. All right. Go ahead, split your forces. You know, that's what got General Custer killed at the Little Bighorn. He split his forces. They went off separate ways, and he had a smaller contingent and ran into a lot of American Indians who, you know, from a variety of different tribes. That could be sort of the similar fate that awaits Israel. Because instead of tribes, you've got different groups within the Shia community, as well as in the Sunni community. I know that as we're coming on air, there are explosions tonight reported in Baghdad. I wouldn't be surprised to see some significant attacks on U.S. embassy facilities in the region. And, you know, we could be back to seeing the kidnapping or assassination of American diplomats. So it's, you know, I said, this thing is now taking an ugly turn because the West has always pretended that it can get away with assassinating, killing whoever it wants, and they're never going to expect blowback from that. I think that now there's going to be blowback.
Who's running the show, Larry, in Washington? Joe Biden? We haven't seen, because they talking about Trump is the most pro-Zionist president, and he was, and he's going to be. But we haven't seen even these type of behavior on the part of Israelis during Trump. And right now, they're doing, Netanyahu just, he simply is doing everything he wants. And it doesn't seem that the United States can even control him.
Well, you obviously didn't get the memo. I mean, Trump is an anti-Semite. The Democrats say so. He's anti-Semitic. He hates the Jews, which is why his daughter is Jewish, his son-in-law is Jewish, his grandchildren from his son-in-law and daughter are Jewish. Yeah, he's anti-Semitic. No, I think, look, I think you're right. Under a Trump presidency, you will see a more pro-Israel stance than is even shown by the Biden administration, if that's possible. Because so far, even though the Biden administration reportedly has said that they were against Israel going into Lebanon, you know, Netanyahu gave them the one finger salute, like, no, hey, okay, thanks for the advice. Now they're going into Lebanon because they know the United States will back them no matter what they do. And look, this predates Joe. This is bipartisan, cuts across party. It goes back to the days when the USS Liberty was attacked by the Israelis and the U.S. government covered it up for years. So, you know, in this case, Israel is going to do what it wants until it gets itself into such trouble that it's going to beg maybe for a U.S. to rescue it. And the sad reality will be the U.S. is in no position to rescue them. Not maybe because we don't, you know, there's lack of will. There's just lack of capability.
Yeah. Larry, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, what was the outcome of Zelensky's visit to the United States?
He racked up a lot of frequent flyer miles. You know, I don't know if he got to eat any scrapple in Pennsylvania. But other than that, maybe he got a new green T-shirt to wear home. But that's it. Yeah, they said he got, oh, yeah, I got $8 billion and more aid. Checks in the mail. You know, so hopefully he's not holding his breath waiting for that thing to clear. He didn't get anything. You know, he wanted full permission to launch attacks into Russia. Russia's policy with respect to the provision of Western aid to Ukraine has changed over the last week and a half. Putin signaled the start of the change at a national security meeting that he held. That meeting, he talked about the proposal that the new policy be that in the future, if, and he didn't say Ukraine, but this is, he could use Ukraine as an example, if Ukraine or Estonia or Lithuania got a weapon system from a nuclear-powered country, United States or the United Kingdom, and use that weapon system against Russia on Russian territory, that it would be treated as a nuclear threat and would elicit appropriate retaliation. That's true. Because if that had been the standard going back 2.5 years, then there'd be a lot of smoking military bases and that had been shredded outside of Ukraine over the last 2.5 years, but it hasn't. But now that's going into place's policy. And I think that's starting to factor into some of U.S. military planning, like, we better be careful here.
And it seems that in Ogledar, they're withdrawing their troops. And how do you find the battlefield right now in Pokrovsk and Ogledar?
Well, it's not just those areas. Across, so you're looking at about 1,000-kilometer line of contact. All along that line of contact, the Russians are moving forward and circling units. They've got, you know, supposedly a brigade surrounded at Vugledor, but that brigade may have been reduced to as many as, you know, fewer than 1,000 men. Normally, a brigade would run around 4,000. That may even be smaller than that. You've got pressure closing in on Chazov Yar, Turetsk, New York, Kursk, all, you know, the Ukrainians are getting crushed and moved back across the line. It's not like they've got one gap that's weakened where the Russians have broken through. They have to plug. There are at least seven major openings in the line right now that Ukraine can't close. And the Russians are in the process of exploiting those.
Joe Biden tweeted that Ukraine will win and we're going to support them. But if you see the face of Zelensky after the meeting with Donald Trump, you don't see that type of hope in his face. And what's your understanding? What's your take on what has happened in that meeting?
Hunter Biden wasn't there to give Zelensky a hit of cocaine, okay? So he was not riding that train high on cocaine. The Casey Jones part of him went out of sort. He didn't get it from Biden. And part of the evidence that he knew he was in trouble was he begged for a meeting with Donald Trump. And Trump took the meeting. But, you know, it was like a scene out of the movie The Godfather, the first Godfather, the opening scene where the Undertaker is begging the Godfather to go kill his daughter's boyfriend who beat her up, get justice. And Don Corleone looks at him and says, you know, he says, "What have I done to you to make you insult me so? Aren't you my friend?" And the Undertaker grabs the Don's hand and kisses it and says, "Be my friend." That was Zelensky. Zelensky is like the Undertaker, asking for this huge favor. And he goes to Donald Trump. And Trump says, "Hey, you know, I got a great relationship with Vladimir Putin. We're friends." And Zelensky goes, "I want to be friends too." You know, God. We ought to have, I don't know if you or some of your international audiences ever watched this guy who was on television here called Mr. Rogers, but he'd put on a sweater and he'd come out and sing a song and, "Let's be friends. Will you be my friend? I want to be your friend." Yeah, this is a Mr. Rogers moment there between the Donald and Zelensky. So the fact that Zelensky had to go make a pilgrimage to Donald Trump, A, shows you that they're calculating that Trump's going to win the election. Because if they were sure that Trump was going to get, you know, beaten, why would they waste their time going to see him? Recognize that they've created Zelensky created a real problem by showing up at what was essentially a Democrat campaign stop in Pennsylvania to go sign the warheads on a couple of artillery shells set to be delivered to Ukraine, and excluding Republicans from that. Pissed a lot of people off. So Zelensky, he didn't come away with people singing his praises. They weren't rising 87 times in the House chamber to applaud him like they did Benjamin Netanyahu.
Larry, how did you find the UN and the way that, because when you look at Benjamin Netanyahu and the way he was using the UN to just people in the gallery just cheering that,
that was his rent a crowd. He went out and rented the crowd, you know, a bunch of people. I promised him free hot dogs afterwards, filled the gallery. The vast majority of the people in the General Assembly, the super delegates, they walked out. Then we're going to listen to his ramblings and rantings. It was really one of the most disgusting plays by a world leader. But it is quintessential BB.
And because if you are in Russia, in Iran, in China, in India, you look at the UN and the way that is working right now, you don't see, they're not capable of finding any sort of solution for what's going on right now in the world, mm-hmm. in Ukraine, in the Middle East. There's just a bunch of leaders going there and talking their point of view without any sort of negotiations, without any sort of mutual understanding. And at the end of the day, what would be the objective of the UN if they're not capable of communication, any sort of communication and mutual understanding?
Yeah, no, I think the UN is on its way out as a viable institution. You know, they're going to try to do some reforms. I mean, one of the immediate reforms is to create a National Security Council that would have, you know, maybe two permanent members from Africa, two permanent members from Southwest Asia, you know, and at least one permanent member from Latin America. So you really could see, and this is why BRICS actually may become sort of an alternative, a viable alternative to the United Nations, for at least for those members who are part of it. They'll, you know, police themselves, and they'll be they'll be more than just a trade organization. They'll be able to do some political things. But no, you're right. Right now, the UN is dysfunctional, completely dysfunctional.
And the way that you've mentioned the new strategy of Russia, do you think right now with what has happened with Zelensky in the United States and the way that Stoltenberg was talking about, we have to support Ukraine and sending them more weapons, and do you find it that they're going to send long-range missiles, or we can be sure that they're not going to send it because they know what would be the reaction on the part of Russians?
Well, I don't think you have to worry about even long-range missiles, any more military support forthcoming, F-16s and such. The new doctrine, that the new decree about Russia's nuclear strategy is going to kick in. So, you know, the countries want to keep, if they want to tempt getting blown up by Russia, go ahead, keep doing it.
And Russia had, in this conflict in the Middle East, Russia had a joint operation together with Syrians on the city of, if I'm not, it just escaped me.
Idlib,
and the other one, there is other city as well, but in Idlib and other cities. And do we know what is the main goal of these operations, and what do they find, how do they find the current conflict in the eyes of Russians, how do they find the current situation of the Middle East?
Well, they've been trying to talk the Iranians into having patience. And that may change now because they counseled not flying off the handle and responding immediately to the Israeli murder of Haniyeh. And with that may have actually been involved with helping broker some of these, getting some assurances from the West. And the fact that the West then violated those assurances to Iran, I think is also resonating for Russia, because Russia has seen the West enable and fund Islamic extremist groups in Syria for the purpose of overthrowing the Syrian government, while they, on the other hand, claim that they're opposed to these radical Islamic groups. I mean, it's just crazy. So, you know, Russia is navigating some choppy waters, but I think it's coming to gain greater support now across the board. More likely, to, you know, better relations, you know, clearly with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Turkey, with Iraq. So, you know, and the United States is going the opposite direction. The United States is not loved, not respected.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry. Great pleasure as always.
For the world, let's hope we survive to see Friday.
See you on Friday.
All right, my friend. All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.